you know, the only positive thing about war is that people suddenly are visited by reality, you know, and Michael Jackson's nose becomes less consequential.
I think everyone in America has a right and an obligation, if they believe something, to speak their opinion.
Israel uses helicopter gunships in the policy of targeted assassinations. Those targeted assassinations are destined singularly for the leaders that have been identified.
And what injustice existed this side of heaven would no doubt be redeemed beyond the pearly gates. God was just once you got past Judgment Day.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, June 13th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. forces killed 27 Iraqi fighters in a ground and air pursuit today after the Iraqis attacked an American tank patrol north of Baghdad, bringing the Iraqi death toll in 4 days of skirmishes to about 100, according to the military. Today's clash came as American forces pressed forward with a massive sweep to crush resistance by supporters of Saddam Hussein's ousted regime north of Baghdad. Air Force General Richard B. Myers said U.S. forces were sifting through intelligence that foreign fighters may have been at an alleged terrorist training camp northwest of Baghdad, bombed early yesterday by U.S. forces. An Iraqi oil pipeline was burning after being sabotaged as the country's crude was set to return to the world market despite an offensive by U.S.-led forces against opponents of their occupation regime. Fires blazed on the major pipeline from Iraq's northern oil fields after what residents said were twin bomb attacks aimed at sabotaging exports through Turkey. U.S. forces in Iraq are checking out sites identified by captured Iraqis as possibly holding biological and chemical weapons. That's according to the commander of the American ground troops. Lieutenant General David McKiernan and Pentagon officials said they had no confirmed discoveries of chemical or biological weapons to announce, but the general said he was confident weapons of mass destruction eventually would be found. Information on chemical and biological weapons is rare because so few Iraqis were involved in those programs, McKiernan told Pentagon reporters over a video link from Iraq's capital, Baghdad. He said, however, that questioning of some Iraqi officials has been fruitful. For some interrogations, we get information that leads us to another source, that we have to go locate certain facilities and go in there and check those out, McKiernan said. I am not going to go into details, but there is discussion from both the chemical and biological side that leads us to intelligence that we have to go confirm or deny. Today, an Israeli gunship fired on a car in Gaza, killing two and injuring others in an escalation of violence in the Middle East. Witnesses also said an F-16 fighter was used in the attacks. Over the past week, several have died in Jerusalem and Gaza and the West Bank. Peace Watch asked Saeed Arakat, correspondent for Al Quds, a Jerusalem-based Arabic daily newspaper, to respond to the latest attacks by Israel and Gaza.
As you saw yesterday, Yasser Taha was killed with his pregnant wife and another child, and many other people. I think Sharon seems to be targeting the Palestinians. He seems to be determined to undermine any effort towards a peaceful resolution of this conflict. On the one hand, he gave the President of the United States some assurances in Aqaba that the targeted killings will cease, they will stop. Then he goes back, and on that same day, they assassinate two Hamas activists. Also, we see that the Sharon government, which is really the extremists that are in power, I mean, they say that Hamas is an extremist group, but the extremists in Israel are in power, and it seems to be targeting the Palestinians. His issue is not with the so-called terrorists or with the extremist groups. His issue seems to be with the Palestinians. The other issue is that using F-16s and helicopter gunships, actually this is in violation of the U.S. Arms Export Act. And I think people ought to look into this issue because Israel has been flaunting all kinds of international rules and regulations, but it is also flaunting the restrictions that the American taxpayers paying for these weapons have put in place to make sure that they are not used to kill innocent people.
Saeed Arakat, correspondent for Al-Quds, a Jerusalem-based Arabic daily newspaper. Just a few days after Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers met with George Bush, violence erupted in the West Bank when Israel targeted Hamas leader Mahmoud al-Zahar in an assassination attempt. 2 days later, a Palestinian blew himself up along with 17 Israelis on a bus in Jerusalem. This violence was followed by an Israeli attack on Hamas leader Yasser Taha, killing Taha, his wife, and three-year-old daughter. Mitch Potter, Middle East correspondent for the Toronto Sun, was in Jerusalem and felt the impact of the explosion shake his home when the bus was detonated. Potter then visited the scene of the Israeli assassination attempt against al-Zahar in Gaza. Peace Watch spoke with him today about his week and asked his opinion of the prospects for peace in the Middle East.
Well, it's just been an absolutely bloody and depressing week. The entire region is crestfallen. There wasn't an enormous amount of hope that came out of the summit at Aqaba 10 days ago, but there was some, and that's something you couldn't say for the past 33 months. And less than a week later, the equation changed all over again. I have to tell you that there's no shortage of blame flying around this region, but whether he deserves it or not, the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today finds himself bearing the brunt of most of that blame. Mm-hmm.
I see an article in the British newspaper The Guardian that's questioning some of Israel's Jews are questioning whether the Prime Minister has Jewish blood on his hands because of his failed assassination attempt of the Hamas leader.
Well, I don't know that I'd go quite that far. That's an incredibly contentious thing to say. I will say that there's a shocking poll that came out today in Israel, and this is something we shouldn't take with a grain of salt. It indicates that as many as half of Israelis actually believe that the strike in Gaza, and I was in Gaza on Tuesday when the strike occurred, on a Hamas leader, Abdelaziz Rantisi, actually came for the reasons of scuttling the peace plan, to sabotage the peace plan. Mm. So what we have are one half of Israelis responding to a public opinion poll that thinks their own government actually was motivated to sabotage the peace plan.
What in the world could have happened that would cause them to come to that conclusion?
Well, it's something that's indefatigable for Israelis to try and get inside the head of Ariel Sharon. He is a hawk. He has always been a hawk. In fact, the largest part of his career has been staked on establishing and expanding the Jewish settlements that are networked throughout the West Bank and Gaza and are considered one of the prime obstacles to peace. Now, there are perhaps half of the political analysts in Israel think that in the wake of the war on Iraq, Sharon has had a huge change of heart, that he believes now that and perhaps the other half of Israelis feeling that Sharon has such an emotional tie to these settlements. And it was an incredible...
3-year-old daughter were killed. Did you visit that scene?
I did, and I was also there on Tuesday in the aftermath of the strike on Rantisi, the event that many analysts here believe really sent this latest cycle into a whirlwind. Israel uses helicopter gunships in the policy of targeted assassinations. Those targeted assassinations are destined singularly for the leaders that have been identified, but in each case, the missiles that get poured into these vehicles end up taking out bystanders. Hamas intended to kill civilians. Israel did not intend to kill civilians, but the net effect remains the same, and that's what's igniting hostilities on both sides.
Mm-hmm. And so the Bush administration announced today that they're sending Colin Powell and other high-level diplomats to try and save what's left of the peace process. What is the role of the U.S. in this process? And in your opinion, can they do anything to try and save it?
In my opinion, the U.S. is the only thing that can save it at this point. And I don't think I'm anywhere near alone on that. I think that just about every observer to this conflict believes that the United States and Bush is the only force anywhere that can really deliver peace in this region.
And what should they do?
Well, the only question is how much will Bush push? He's going to have to push Israel, and he's going to have to push the Palestinians on both sides as hard as he can to live up to their promises of Aqaba. It's clear that the majority of Israelis value the relationship with the United States so much that whatever Bush will say will go. at the end of the day. And Palestinians have nothing to lose. They have nothing. And so, quite frankly, anything along those lines, they'll embrace wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. He takes an enormous political risk in pushing too hard. And for that reason, many observers in the Middle East thought that Bush just never wanted to get involved here. He saw it as a disaster for Clinton. He saw it as a disaster for all his predecessors. And this is the great surprise of Aqaba, is that Bush actually staked considerable political capital in actually coming to the region and using the words and the energy that he did use.
And, of course, it would be a great feather in his cap to have it end on his watch.
It would be perhaps the greatest legacy of any American president in our lifetime, in my view.
And so you feel as though Ariel Sharon is just too closely associated with the settlements to really want to be able to deliver peace to the Middle East. What about the Palestinian side of the equation? Have they simply, in this particular increase in violence, been reacting to the violence that was perpetrated on them?
Well, you have to look at the Palestinians as a fragmented, divided society. The Palestinian Authority, which is the titular leadership, is absolutely powerless at this point. They are incredibly weakened. You have Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, which is also known by the name Abu Mazen, who has single-digit support, and he's the one that stood up at Aqaba to make the commitments to Ariel Sharon and to George Bush. You have in the wings Yasser Arafat, who is a wild card in this equation. It is in the interest of Bush and Sharon to basically erase Arafat from the equation, but in fact he is the symbol of Palestinian nationhood, the struggle they've been fighting for now 4 decades. And he is not about to walk out the door anytime soon. Mm. In addition to this, you have a rival force by the name of Hamas, a terrorist entity, but also a humanitarian entity, which has gained enormous energy, particularly on the streets of Gaza. They're seen as being the only force that's looking out for Palestinian interests right now. And with every strike against Hamas, it becomes stronger on the street. And the fledgling prime minister that everybody hopes will push this roadmap along, Mahmoud Abbas, becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. That's the terrible dynamic we have here now. It's absolutely clearly understood that what U.S. diplomats want to see happen is for Israel to improve the conditions on the ground in the occupied territories, and that in turn will improve Mahmoud Abbas's standing amongst the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. What they want to see are improvements in their daily lives, the closures, the home demolitions, the limitations to their existence under Israeli occupation. They want to see improved. And this, in fact, is what America wants to see improve on the part of Israel. Mm-hmm. That will improve Mahmoud Abbas's standing and give some kind of marginal hope to march forward.
What are the chances that Colin Powell, when he goes to the West Bank, will try to include someone from Hamas or Yasser Arafat's camp to try and really put together a scenario or an equation that might actually work?
It's a very tricky order of business for Powell to play that game, because in effect, Israel has a very good point in its defense. It says, what, and you're going to negotiate with terrorists? And this puts the Bush administration on a very difficult plane. What we, in fact, won't see but will be happening is diplomatic activity beneath the radar. There mm-hmm. have been and there will continue to be negotiations with Hamas involving the Palestinian Authority, involving other leaders and diplomats from the Arab world, to try and bring this organization to heel.
Mitch Potter, Middle East correspondent to the Toronto Star and the reporter who broke the real Jessica Lynch story. Well, for decades, celebrities have played a visible role in American political life. Does that role change during times of war or when the U.S. faces national security issues? In today's segment from our Civil Liberties Desk, writer-director Tim Robbins speaks to Stephen Rohde, host of Clear and Present Danger, about the threat self-censorship poses to the most fundamental of our civil liberties, free speech.
Today we're joined by Tim Robbins, an acclaimed actor, director, producer, writer, having written Cradle Will Rock and the film script for Dead Man Walking and Bob Roberts. Tim, recently you spoke out against the war in Iraq and suffered some repercussions from that. Would you tell us that story of how you were invited to the Baseball Hall of Fame and what arose out of that?
Well, I'd been talking to the Baseball Hall of Fame for a year and a half about this anniversary celebration they wanted to do for the film Bull Durham. And I had been up there on several occasions and had donated my uniform to the museum from Bull Durham and had taken both of my boys on separate occasions and together on road trips to go to the different Hall of Fames on the East Coast in the United States. So I always loved Cooperstown, and I still do. I think it's a great museum. I love baseball. And so we were setting up this little event, and about 2 weeks before the event, I got a letter from the president of the Hall of Fame, basically disinviting me and Susan because of our views on the war, saying that we were compromising the safety of the troops by being opposed to the war. I was starting to write a response to it when I got a phone call from my office saying that the AP, the Associated Press, wanted a comment. And I said, what do you mean? And apparently the Hall of Fame had sent out the letter to me, to the AP, at the same time as sending it to me. So it became clear to me that what was happening was that this wasn't really a matter of disinviting us. It was more a matter of sending a message, a broadside out across America through the AP, to basically send a message to other people, which is essentially that if you oppose this administration, there can and will be repercussions. So I talked to the AP reporter, and the next day it kind of blew up. It was a huge story. And you asked me about what happened. I have to say, I see nothing but positive things from this. First of all, what happened was there was an amazing amount of support in the papers, from the New York Times op-ed page to sports writers throughout the country. Hundreds and hundreds of articles written about free speech and about what the Baseball Hall of Fame did, and decrying what they did, criticizing what they did. And so in a way it was a real positive thing that happened, because another message was sent out across America, which was that this was wrong and that we should have the right to dissent. And a big argument started about dissent and about what right does an administration have to have absolute compliance and its citizens. It's just, you know, so the larger issue is I think, the more important thing. You know, the larger debate was started by this.
I found it ironic. The president's speech, the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame, was defending the fact that troops have died for defending our freedoms. Well, the freedoms those troops and others have sacrificed for are the freedoms to speak out and to defend your position. Did you find that ironic? And I know you wrote back to him as well.
Well, that's ironic. It's ironic also. What I find even more disturbing is that all this talk of patriotism and supporting the troops, you have an administration that just cut $844 million of health care benefits from veterans this year alone. You also have an administration where most of the players in it, I think Colin Powell is the only one that actually saw any kind of battle in a war. A lot of the other major players in this war chose not to when their country was calling them to serve in Vietnam, either by taking stateside jobs in National Guard or in complete aversion to the draft. Cheney got four deferments and one marriage deferment to stay out of Vietnam. Rumsfeld served but never saw action. Ashcroft got deferments. Wolfowitz, Pearl, both skirted service in Vietnam. So you've got a whole bunch of guys that are talking a good game, but when they were young enough to put their lives on the line, they chose not to. So I find an incredible hypocrisy in that. Not only with that, but also with the fact that this is an administration is cutting benefits from veterans. And I've gotten a great amount of letters from veterans of the Gulf War, of the Vietnam War, in complete support of what we were saying and what I was advocating and my right to say it. Sometimes letters from people that didn't agree with what I was having to say, but also at the same time very strongly stressing that what they did was wrong and that we all should be able to have opinions in this country.
All the commentary wasn't positive. Some people said it's one thing to oppose a war, But once the war has started, once the troops are in battle, then it is disloyal and undermines national unity to continue to oppose the war while the troops are in battle. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that if we believe that logic, then we would still be in Vietnam. I think you have to have I think you first have to know that these are well-trained men. They are not going to be any less efficient in their jobs because some people in America are protesting. How many people have come up to me that said I've gone to my first protest and I feel so much better? To be able to go out and be with other people and to in a community is absolutely essential in times like this. But you also have to understand, I'm one voice. Susan's one voice. There's maybe been 10 voices out there that have been opposing this war, and they've been jumped on. And you have to ask the question, what is it that is so threatening about what we're saying that such vehemence has been used to try to shut us up? I got to believe that they maybe don't really believe they have the support out there. Their poll numbers are pretty good right now, but their poll numbers before the war were not good. So how did that leap happen? And everywhere I go, there's people that have big doubts about what we did. And I'm sure there's a lot of supporters out there, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that would rather not think about it and rather believe that war is like a football game and that once it's over, and you could spike the ball in the end zone and we've won. But there's still people being compromised over there. There's still American soldiers dying over there, and we've just kind of shut it off and moved on to some murder case, you know, in California.
This all seems part of a whole controversy over Martin Sheen speaking out, Mike Farrell, yourself, Susan Sarandon, the Dixie Chicks. Do celebrities have the same rights of free speech as everybody else? Or
of course they do. And I'd just like to say something about the nature of people that are calling us to question, the people that are on the talk radio and on the cable news channels. Once again, an incredible hypocrisy. All of those guys had a chance to serve their country in Vietnam and chose not to. Rush Limbaugh got a deferment. Tony Snow, Bill O'Reilly, all of them somehow found ways to skirt service in Vietnam, stay at home, safe. Now, if a veteran is going to come and address me and talk to me about why he feels what I was doing might be compromising some kind of safety over there, I might listen. And that's a person I'd like to have a conversation with, to hash it out with. But when you have people like that are such hypocrites, calling to question my patriotism, I just have to laugh. I have to say, you know, what they're doing is basically their cultural contribution to this country has been to turn people from indifference to hatred. And I don't think that's a very positive achievement for any of those people. And that's their legacy. It's ultimately their legacy is that they've created a lot of distrust and anger. And it's not healthy for our country. We should be able to tolerate dissent. The president didn't help things much when he was asked by Tom Brokaw about it. He said, about the Dixie Chicks, he said, they have a right to say what they want to, but they shouldn't get their feelings hurt when people don't buy their CDs. Now, a real leader would have said, listen, folks, they have the right to say it, and we shouldn't punish them for saying that, because that's not in the spirit of America. But instead, he had to get that little dig in there. And as last I checked, the Dixie Chicks really didn't have their feelings hurt because people weren't buying their CDs. I think it was more the fact that we were getting death threats and that their CDs were being smashed in very public displays and that major conglomerates had banded together to boycott their music. That is a little different than people making the individual decision when they go to a record store not to buy their CD.
Other critics say, well, what do you know about weapons of mass destruction, foreign policy? Why should you be given a platform to speak on these important issues?
Why not? I don't know a tremendous amount about weapons of mass destruction, but I trust that there are experts that do, and the experts that were going in there and dismantling not weapons of mass destruction but other weapons and were searching for them seemed to think that they were doing a job that was efficient and that would, that given more time, they could have gotten to more. I think everyone in America has a right and an obligation, if they believe something, to speak their opinion. I think the subtext of that kind of argument that you just were expressing is that no one has a right to speak except for experts, and the experts will be determined by the networks and by the administration. And I'm sorry, I don't buy that. I would love to live in a situation where I don't have to do this, but I'm sorry, there's no opposition in this country. Where did the Democrats go? Where was that? Where was the debate? Robert Byrd, and that's about it. So, you know, yeah, you present an opposition party, and I'll shut up. I won't say a thing when there's someone out there saying it. I don't have a desire to be heard or seen on my political beliefs, but I just look at the void, and I say I have an opportunity to say something that millions of people say and think every day. Why not take that opportunity? Yeah, there might be career ramifications. Yeah, there might be some kind of, you know, quasi-blacklist. But ultimately, it's going to be more demeaning and destructive to me personally if I sit on my hands and I play it safe and I, you know, try to suppress what I'm thinking.
A few years ago, you reminded all of us in Cradle Will Rock of the period of the Federal Theater Project in 1937 and another form of censorship when government took action to close down a theater group that was trying to speak out. What's your historical sense of where we are today in the context of other times when efforts have been made to suppress dissent?
First of all, I don't believe in paranoiac notions. I think that once you buy into them, you might as well throw in the towel. You're not going to use your rights if you really believe there's an awesome power out there that's trying to suppress your thought or suppress your opinion. I don't believe in that kind of thing. I believe that at this particular juncture, there's a lot of fear about speaking out, and I think that probably is good reason for that, because there are ramifications in the workplace and elsewhere. We've seen happening across the country little incidents of people being fired for their beliefs. Where in context, I don't know. It's hard to say. Historically, this has happened before. But at the same time, I think we still have our rights here in this country, and we can still use them. And if they're going to really, you know, it depends on how far they're going to go in trying to suppress them. But right now, we all have that right to still speak, so we should use it.
We call this program Clear and Present Danger. What do you think today in the United States or around the world is the greatest clear and present danger to freedom of expression itself?
Self-censorship. The thought pattern that takes place that says to the self, don't speak.
Thank you, Tim, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Clear and Present Danger with host Stephen Rohde. The show is a production of PEN USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer is Deborah Jones. Eileen Moskowitz is the producer. The editor is Mark Torres. And to order this show, go to www.pacificaradioarchives.org. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.